You're locked in here with me. In honor of a pandemic, what are you watching while self-quarantined?
I'm Katie Rich, and I am still watching Schitt's Creek, which I started a year ago on Netflix, and I've just now gotten to all the sappy romantic parts with David and Patrick, and it's fun.
Oh, I'm David the Seven, and I'm watching The Simpsons on Disney Plus, even though it's still in the wrong fucking aspect ratio. Fix it, Disney Plus!
And I am David Ehrlich, and I will be watching, as my wife and I have been watching off and on for, I think, like 5 years now, maybe a little bit less than that. ER, we are up to season 8. Still good. Julie Delpy just showed up out of nowhere. Yeah.
Julie Delpy was on ER.
Who knew? Really one of the greatest television shows I've ever seen. I'm sure it continues to go downhill a little bit, but the highs of those first 6 or 7 seasons are kind of unassailable. What a show. It's on Hulu, the whole thing. All 315 episodes.
Age of Ultron's Julie Delpy.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 292, and it is the week of Wednesday, March 11th, 2020. That was the day that in 1997, Paul McCartney was knighted. Feels like it shouldn't have taken that long, but I guess 1997 was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago.
I feel like I've thought of him in my head as Sir Paul McCartney for a long time, but maybe I'm just putting too much importance in being knighted.
I mean, you were like, all of our brains were soft enough when it was like, drilled into the mainstream's head, we had to call him Sir Paul McCartney.
Yeah, that's true. It's
just sort of, it came with it.
Yeah, I just now think he's a literal knight. Anyway, as you might have heard, Matt Patches is not with us, but we are going to have a guest in segment 3. Should I reveal it, or should I like leave it as a
leave it as a tease? But you should leave the guest as a tease, but reveal the reason Matt Patches is not here.
I think we're going to put his name in the title, though. So,
that's true.
I think you can reveal both.
Yeah. Well, Eric Vespy is going to come on to talk about South by Southwest and his short film, Seek, which was going to play in South by before it was canceled due to coronavirus. And Matt Patches is sick, but we don't think because of coronavirus. Although
we have no reason to suspect otherwise. He seems to be on the fence.
Yeah. We don't know. There probably aren't enough tests in his area. It's best to just assume he's got the coronavirus.
Yeah. Well, we haven't seen him in person. So I think we're immune unless you can catch it through podcasts. No proof you can't.
Well, even so, he's not on this one, so we're safe for a little bit.
I actually have found proof that you can catch it through podcasts. Some of the podcasts I listen to, maybe this episode. Be careful out there, kids. We have reviews. We have a review in the singular, which we like to have reviews, but we will make do with the review, especially if it's a nice one from listener Sabina Syed, who writes a request or two. It's 5 stars. I'm writing this review to backdoor a simple request. Any chance of either turning down the honking noise or just losing it altogether? Ooh, controversial. I cannot tell you the amount of times I'm listening to a different podcast. Fitwear is queued up next, and my eardrums are just destroyed by that horn. Also, adding the intro-outro music into the show notes would be fun. Love the pod. Great people. Cheers all around. This review was very helpful, as all recommendations are. Dave, do you, as our valiant sound engineer, do you have any thoughts on
that? I have responses to both of these, actually. Number one, I will work on getting the honking lower. It goes lower basically every time someone makes one of these requests. It may not sound like it because I also still want it to serve its kind of surprising purpose, but I will comply once again. We'll get it there. The other thing is I don't list the podcast things in the show notes because why entice somebody to go looking for the copyrights I'm violating? So, if you would like to tweet at me at DA7E or at FITWR, and just ask what it is, I'll gladly pass it on because you should absolutely buy the things you like. But yeah, I used to list them, don't list them anymore because it just seems like flying a pirate flag in open waters.
I know nothing of these alleged copyright violations and would distance myself from this entirely.
Well, the important thing is we've complied to all our, flags thus far, which has only been won by the artist Hobo Johnson. And now that podcast has blank segments or blank sections in between segments. Anyway,
Consequences
that's the answer to both your questions.
Once again.
Yeah, we're not going to cut the horn. I'll keep trying to bump it down.
Leave us more reviews. Patches will come back. I don't know if that will make you want to leave more or less reviews, but leave us a review. Opening in a tiny amount of theaters last weekend was the Kelly Reichardt movie First Cow, which would normally be the kind of movie that opens in New York and LA, and Dave and I wait for weeks and weeks to talk about it because we haven't gotten the chance to see it. I was lucky enough to get to see it earlier. So now I get to make David talk to me about First Cow, which is, Kelly Reichardt has been one of my favorite filmmakers for a really long time. I guess probably, no, Winnie and Lucy came before Meek's Cutoff. This is, very much in the wheelhouse of a lot of movies she's made. It's set in the Pacific Northwest. It is like Meek's Cutoff, a period piece. It is like an early film of hers, Old Joy, which I actually haven't seen. A kind of about friendship between two men, this time set in the Old West. It's also, I mean, some of her movies have been plotty. A lot of them have been very unplotty. I think I like the extent of the Swiss one, to which this one is a little bit plotted, so that it's kind of like a caper, which I think is probably helping lead to some of its rave reviews. Like, her movies are very slow and deliberate, and you need to be able to watch a minute-long shot of a boat going down a river or someone putting on their shoes and let that be part of your experience. But First Cow is also about these, like, two dudes kind of inventing capitalism for themselves in the Oregon territories. I haven't actually looked at the box office numbers, but it feels like one of those, like, A24 small-scale indie box office hits.
It's opened on so few screens that it's hard to get a sample size, but it did very well on those screens in its first weekend.
I love First Cow, and David, I imagine you do too.
I feel like I would love First Cow, but I have not seen First Cow because I am a piece of trash. A24 very kindly sent me a link of the film after I bailed out on three different screenings which is no offense to Kelly Reichardt, but when making evening screening plans when you have a newborn is tempting fate, especially when you are not assigned to cover something. My boss Eric Cohn covered it out of Telluride last year where it premiered. I think as our colleague Sam Adams was pointing out rightly on Twitter today, it was kind of overlooked. I mean, I think people took stock of it and really enjoyed it, but smaller films that are not opening as part of the awards race, I mean, it was already clear this was going to be opening in 2020, tend to be minimized and marginalized in those settings. It's just a shame.
And it played at the New York Film Festival too, right?
It did. But Katie, talk to me. I mean, the thing that the thing that makes me most excited to find some time to kick back and put it on the monitor of my computer, which is only so big, and turn off the lights and sip a cognac or something, or a sleepy time tea, because I don't drink cognac, but a sleepy time tea with way too much raw honey, like a demented amount of raw honey, is that everyone says this movie is very warming, very gentle, very sweet, nice core, if you will, and maybe you won't, I don't know. But it sounds like nice counter-programming to reality right now, even if not, you know, Kelly Reichardt, I think, is not making a dishonest film. She's not capable of making a dishonest film about the world. I'm sure it is not paved over to be a fairy tale, but is still, I don't know, humane or empathetic or bovine in a way that might be nice to watch these days.
Yeah, I know you invented the term nice core, so I shouldn't question its definition, but like my only understanding what nice core is that it's Paddington.
Yeah. He's the official mascot of nice core.
Well, I mean, Paddington would probably be as out of place in the Oregon territory as the main character in First Cow is. Cookie Figowitz, played by John Magaro, who is,
that's a name.
Oh my God, it is the name. Like, I cannot think of a name in cinema in the last couple of years that I like more than this. His real name is Otis, which is also a great name, Otis Figowitz, but they call him Cookie because he is the cook for this, like, party of beaver fur trappers in the Oregon Territory, and he's kind of terrible at it. He doesn't really want to kill animals. He's terrible at fishing. He trained as a baker in Boston and really just, like, wants to open a bakery, which is kind of this dream he opens up about when he teams up with this guy who is Chinese. He made his way to the territory. I mean, he says he's with a party of Russians. There's kind of no reason not to believe him, but there's kind of no reason to believe him. He's kind of like the charismatic outlaw of the two of them. But he's also Chinese, so obviously he stands out in a major way in this, you know, area that's dominated by a bunch of white men who are really working hard to edge out the Native American people who are there. Kelly Reichardt, among her many ways that she kind of reinvents Westerns in her movies, is she incorporates the Native people in this really seamlessly and like points to them being there and being just part of everybody's lives. This character played by Toby Jones, who's the chief factor, who is like, I don't even know what it is. He's like running a military base out of there. I don't know what the like official position he has, but he's the rich guy. He is the guy who has brought in the first cow in the Oregon Territory so that he can have milk for his tea. He is married to a Native woman who is played by Lily Gladstone, who you might remember from Certain Women.
Wait, well, I am just hearing about this for the first time. I'm now even more excited to see it.
I know. Well, aren't you so glad? Because like Certain Women has like Laura Dern and Kristen Stewart. It's like the starriest movie Kelly Reichardt's ever made. And I'm glad that of all the people that she brought back, that it was Lily Gladstone, who was just ruled in that movie. Didn't she win like the New York Film Critics Award or some kind of supporting actress prize that year?
Yeah, something I can't remember off the top of my head, but she certainly deserved it.
Also, it explains why I keep thinking that Toby Jones' part is played by Jared Harris in this movie, because Jared Harris was in Certain Women. Anyway. She's great in it. And you just kind of get this picture of this world, this like incredibly rough world where the thing that, Cookie and his friend King Lou come up with, that's like their big genius plan, is they make these things they call oily cakes, which are basically like beignets or donuts, that they make using the milk they steal from this cow. They kind of sneak in under the cover of darkness and milk the cow, and Cookie like has conversations with her, which are like incredibly sweet and funny. And they provide this tiny luxury to all of these men who are just supposed to be out there like making money or like starting wars with Indian tribes and all these horrible things, but they all want like a little donut with honey on it. And it's just so attentive to like what people need in addition to like just the tiny little things that make their lives worth living. And then this, like this little friendship that kind of builds up around it. And I don't think it qualifies as nice core, because I think it's too blunt about the danger that's just around every possible corner and how hard it is to live out there, how hard these people are, like how hard they make themselves to fit in there. Mm-hmm. But it really celebrates the humanity that you can find in there, even if it doesn't work out that well for you. Like you don't ever sense at any point that Cookie is going to like thrive out there. So there's this like menace to it, but it appreciates him for a while he lasts.
Now, can I,
part of the niceness you're talking about,
can I tell you the one thing that I do know about this movie, which blows my mind, is that it's adapted from a novel in which there is no cow.
Really?
Yes.
I knew that it was adapted from a novel. I didn't know there was no cow.
Well,
the cow.
I have a lot of questions.
The cow is an invention, and apparently quite a major one, of Kelly Reichardt's.
Wow. So, well, the author of the novel is the co-screenwriter, so I guess he gave his blessing.
Oh, sure, yeah. He was like, Kelly Reichardt went to him, and she was like, you know what this story, which was otherwise fine, needs? And he was like, what? And she said, a cow. And he was like, God damn it, where were you when I spent 10 years writing this book?
The name of the guy he teams up with.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait to watch this, and,
yeah, everybody see First Cow. I assume, like, you know, a lot of Kelly Reichardt movies have been, like, distributed by, like, Oscilloscope or really tiny distributors. A24 tends to go a little bit bigger, so I think, I would imagine it will certainly open in Denver, at least, maybe here where I live. People will get a chance to see it as it expands, and it's really worth it. And if you do wind up watching it at home, do what David said. Turn off the lights, focus, watch that boat go down the river. It'll reward you.
You know, as we sometimes do in this show, we're going to cover something very esoteric that has not been, I've not seen talked about on the internet or anywhere else over the past couple of weeks. And that is a Netflix show called Love is Blind, which is sort of like The Bachelor, except for the difference is that I give a shit. And it's a wild reality dating show that, you know, despite the jest of the opening of this segment, has actually been quite popular. And I think I didn't get around to it until, because Netflix aired it one episode at a time over the course of a number of weeks, and I didn't get around to it until it was already online, which is perfect for me because this show is ridiculously addictive, despite yourself sometimes. But it's a reality show. It's a dating show. And the premise of the show is that they get these people together, some men, some women, all of whom are kind of conventionally attractive, which is a demerit against the show for some people, I guess, given the premise, which I will now explain. And they put them on opposite sides of a corridor and into one-on-one pods, and they have the men and the women have long dates, they call them, across the divide of these pods, but they cannot see one another at all. The only thing they can know about one another is what they say to each other. And I think they are free, although probably discouraged, to talk about what they look like. But the whole point of this experiment, which Nick Lachey and Vanessa Lachey show up for 3 seconds in the entire 10-episode run of the show to remind us, is to prove whether love is blind. And these are people who presumably had difficulties finding, making love work by their own devices. And so they want to lean into the gimmick.
Wait, we presume that and not just that they wanted to be on a reality show?
I'm being generous here. Okay. And they go into this house knowing that the idea is, and I think, you know, you set the bar at a certain place and people will meet it, that they will leave the house engaged to someone, not just dating, not just like, mm-hmm. Oh, I want to pick someone to go on some dates with. They will commit their whole hearts the rest of their times on this mortal coil to a person they have never seen in the flesh. And so the first few episodes mm-hmm. are them talking and falling in love and figuring out which one of them they want to pick. And then we see them meet each other. The meetings, I think, start happening in the second episode. And it's all very exciting. And then they go to Mexico together in the flesh. And then they have like 6 weeks to prepare for their wedding. And the whole thing is, at the end of that time, are they going to say I do or I don't? And it's such a monogamously organized show that every time, because there are more people in the pods in the beginning than you see in the main show. And anyone who doesn't couple up is immediately just disappeared. And anytime a relationship implodes over the course of the show, those two people, it's gone. And so it's really just winnowing down to the couples on the show. But what I enjoyed about it, other than the ridiculous stakes and the fact that it feels like a sadistic experiment that was designed by the serial killer Jigsaw, and the fact they go along with it is really horrific to watch, is that Netflix gives a little bit more wiggle room to the reality show format than something like ABC can, and not just because they can swear and they can allude at more sex, and we can be frank about the sex that they do have when they talk about it afterwards, but it just doesn't have the same stringency, and as a result, you feel less, like there's less bullshit. The concept is so insane that the reactions to it can almost only be human in response to it. And every step of the way, as warped as some of these people are, and as much of a shot in the dark as some of them may be fame chasing, I don't know, there is a genuineness that emerges from all of them, for better or worse. And the reunion show confirmed that in a way that I've never really seen from a reality show before, where you really sort of was able to show that while there are obviously drastic editing choices that are made in the show that impact what you think of these people and how you see their stories, the heart of what was happening was very true, and also just like the weight of it all, that some of these people are still married to each other. It's been a year now, and you really get a sense that it's a living culture of a relationship and not just something that is done for the camera, in a way that I'd not gotten from a reality show before. But I found it fascinating and well cast. I think there's a lot of opportunities to expand upon it, and to diversify the cast going forward. I don't know. Katie and Dave, did either of you watch this?
You almost talked about this last week. But we shuffled it off to this week. So I was like, maybe I should check out what David's talking about with this show. And I couldn't get past the first episode and just the premise that this was going to be a series of conversations between people in pods that would eventually have to come out engaged. Seems fine. But everybody's like introductory interview seemed bachelor level or even more shallow. So I'm encouraged that you say that, you know, once they start meeting, things sort of start complicating. But as someone who watches a lot of reality TV because I work for a reality TV show, it was really weird for me to see the setup and the premise and little things, like they didn't know the name of the show when they started filming it, so they always refer to like Love Being Blind or looks not being a thing, but they never say like, this is like Love is Blind. This is like, I think at one point Nick Lachey calls it the Blind Love Challenge. Anyway, all stuff that isn't really important, if like the actual drama of the show works, because that should be the point of a reality TV show. But it feels really weird to me, the same way that The Bachelor feels weird to me, to like make a show out of it and then also be claiming the entire time that you're not making a show out of it.
So the idea that you're right. And the whole like Love is Blind premise is completely at odds with the appeal of the show and what they're doing. Like it sets up the couples, but every time Nick Lachey comes back, and he's like, I'm obviously Nick Lachey. This is the first line that has become sort of mythic already from the pilot. But it just seems really irrelevant to what's interesting about the show. Like, it's so much more about the connections that they make and if they're going to see it through and what they learn about people. I mean, it's just not really relevant to the physicality of it all. I don't know. It feels like they really try to force that. And Nick Lachey and Vanessa Lachey's the whole marching orders were to push that forward. And once the editors realized it was sort of tertiary to the appeal of the show, they disappeared from the show themselves.
I guess I'm going to ask a question, and it might be rhetorical, maybe not. Let's see how it goes. But if you're watching people who sign up for a competition show knowing they're going to be married and then they're still together at the reunion for that show that might have a second season where they're still married.
No, they wouldn't be on the second season.
Did you watch?
I mean,
either way. But
you're coming at it from a...
The question stands. Did you watch?
Yeah. You.
Like, what did you watch?
You have a better brain about this stuff than I do because you're thinking in a way that it hadn't really clicked into place for me yet, that like they would be a spin-off show potentially about that couple. Cause why not? I mean, teen mom, young and pregnant, you know, 16 and pregnant, et cetera.
Oh yeah. Or they could be the hosts because Nick Lachey was dumb, of like the next one. But like the point being is that when we live in a world where, competition reality TV is a way that a certain group of people make money.
Yeah.
Like, did you watch two people fall in love?
You know,
the question might, the answer might be yes, but even so, like, what does that say?
It's a fair question. I think one of the reasons why my bullshit detector went off a little bit less than usual is because as the series goes on, they really confront socioeconomic circumstances more than, The Bachelor ever would, for example. Not that I actually have an indexical knowledge of The Bachelor. I'm just guessing on the bits and drabs I've seen. Certainly not the other reality shows that I've seen, of this nature, if there is another show of this nature. But, they really lean into it. The jobs that they've worked in, the way where they live. I mean, it's more front and center. And, I don't know. I would like to think that because of my, really all of our diets and watching culture and what we do professionally, that I would have a decent bullshit detector. I could still enjoy it, even if I don't wholeheartedly buy what I'm seeing. I certainly can't predict what's going to happen. I mean, I think there's some pretty tempestuous couples that stay together on the show. I'm not going to stake anything on whether or not they'll still be married a year from now. But I do feel like, especially after watching the reunion show, that to the best of their ability, the contestants' ability, to the extent of their, you know, hearts, for lack of a better term, they are real about where they are. I mean, there's just too much. It goes back to the stakes. I mean, there's just like so much on the, I don't know. I mean, it sounds, if you haven't watched it, it sounds like I could be talking about any reality show. And the stakes of being on Netflix or on national television are implicit, you know, regardless of whether or not you're talking about marriage. But, I believed in who these people were as characters. And then there were moments where I didn't, and the reunion righted that in a way. You never go broke underestimating people's lust for fame. So who knows, but this show did not trigger my cynicism in that way so much as it triggered my shock at, like, I can't believe this is where society is at and we're all just watching this. And it all just feels really, really intense. But I don't know.
It's a great time to be wondering about the state of society.
Yeah, that's true.
It leads us to our next segment.
Let's.
Okay, we're going to start our segment three with the first guest we've had on this podcast in years, literal years. This is not something we do very often, but lucky us that it's Eric Vespi who's decided to join us. Hey, Eric.
Hey, Katie. What's new?
Well, I wish you were on here just to chat about whatever, which would obviously be delightful. But we wanted to bring you on, given the news in the last couple of days about South by Southwest, which obviously, if you're listening to this, you probably know it's been canceled. Eric, you, I think of you as a titan of the Austin film community. I'm sure you would say the same for yourself, obviously.
I hope that's not a fat joke.
No, like a colossus, a great statue.
Yes.
But also this year you were a South by filmmaker, which makes this cancellation, I mean, I don't know, it just sucks all the more, right?
Yeah, no, it was a double whammy for sure. This year I had a horror short called Seek that I wrote and produced actually make the cut, which, you know, is pretty big news, you know, for any filmmaker, because they get 6,000 short submissions and they only program like 60. So, you know, that those are pretty, you know, lotto winning odds to make the final cut anyway. And so, you know, I had that side of it of like, we were, me and, Aaron Morgan, my creative partner and director of the short, we were, you know, preparing for our big premiere, and we had like guests coming in, and we had like our actors were flying in, and, you know, and then the thing gets canceled, and, you know, obviously that's a gut punch. But you know, the other side of it is I've been, writing about films since the mid to late 90s online, and I've been covering South by Southwest as a film reporter since then, since my high school days, actually. And you know, it was always a fun, you know, local festival. You know, now it's a giant, huge, big deal festival on top of that. But you know, since I left Ain't It Cool News and have entered the freelance journalism life, you know, it's become, you know, a pretty important income generator for a freelancer. I got more work at South by last year in 10 days than I did in 2 months, you know, any random 2 months of the year. You know, and that's just how it is. It's kind of a boom or bust thing. So I got hit, you know, kind of on two fronts with the news. But I do, you know, want to stress that, like, everybody at South by, you know, had to make, you know, is dealing with an impossible situation right now, right? Everybody at the festival itself, there was just a story about them having to lay off a third of their full-time staff. You know, it's as much as I, you know, am a narcissist and want to make everything about me, you know, it's hard to feel bad about, you know, for yourself whenever you know, you see these stories of people losing their, you know, their full-time job, and people, Austin restaurants and bars and gig economy workers, you know, potentially not making rent. You know, the whole thing's a real sad, you know, heartbreaking situation.
It's almost impossible to wrap your head around how many people have been affected by this. And I was reading in the Times over the weekend that there were viability issues about continuing South by Southwest as a business because they lost so much money over this and have to find a way to stop the bleeding by the summer. And then, you know, I was talking about that with someone just a little while ago, and they were saying that the city of Austin, and this is not based on anything other than, you know, hope and a wing and a prayer, but the city of Austin wouldn't let that happen. I mean, you know, as much as you can, as an institution of Austin yourself, as much as you can wrap your head around that, like, can you imagine a scenario where the city would allow that to happen, and would South by Southwest become a thing in the past?
I wouldn't think so, because it is such a huge revenue generator for the city. You know, I think that the last numbers I saw from last year was somewhere in the neighborhood of $335 million comes in, you know, every year for it. So I have to imagine the city of Austin would look at a long-term solution, right? You know, even if there's some sort of bailout or, mm-hmm. you know, covering, you know, where they get paid back or, you know, something like, again, I'm no politician. So, you know, perhaps they don't.
Maybe this is your time.
Really yeah, you run yeah. out of sound.
Throw your hat in the ring.
Yeah, watch out, Ted Cruz. I'm going to come for you.
I mean, hey, take advantage of the fact that he's quarantined. Get out there on the campaign trail.
Yeah, speaking of, I saw a hilarious tweet about that. They were saying that there have been no Zodiac killings since he's been in quarantine. You know, how funny is that? You know, it's like, it's suspicious. Undeniable. Can't argue with that. Listen, I don't know what Austin looks like without South by, you know, from an arts perspective. I really don't know. And I also don't know what the industry itself looks like, because Austin's been on the forefront and South by Southwest has been on the forefront of not just film and music for as long as I've been here. And I've been here since I was 12 years old. It's also been on the forefront of the tech boom, right? It's like the tech side, the interactive side of South by is even bigger than the other two sides now. And, you know, it's so much is launched out of, you know, out of that. Like, I'm sure somebody would come in and fill the void. That always happens. But, you know, I don't know. I just don't know. You know, in the short term, it's definitely a huge loss for the artistic community.
As a filmmaker who was, you know, going to be represented there and premiere there, what are your just logical next steps now?
I mean, that's a good question. I would say one of the interesting things about the power of South by Southwest is that just being accepted as a short film has given us such a huge boost to visibility. I mean, no way a Hollywood Reporter ran a story on the short, and no way that would have happened if it was just, you know, the Palm Springs Film Festival or something. Not to put down Palm Springs, I'm sure it's a great film festival, but, you know, there's only a few powerhouses out there that actually will get eyeballs on things. And just from the sheer fact of being picked and chosen for this festival, you know, our little horror short has, you know, we've had outreach from producers and managers and, you know, and of course the ultimate goal is to try to make a feature, you know, version of this horror short. And just by being programmed, not even having the premiere, just by being programmed, we've already kind of got the benefit of that. So, you know, our next step with the short is to continue rolling it out. Chattanooga Film Festival is the next one up. Florida has announced us, and we have, you know, we've submitted to, you know, all the festivals that you could imagine, you know, going into the fall.
I mean, it sounds like in some ways you might be in a more advantageous position as the filmmakers of a short than you would be with a feature that needs a little bit more of a springboard of the actual event, not just the you know, the seal of approval.
Well, yeah, and there's so much more at stake with the feature, right? Because you're, you know, we've invested, you know, real time and resources into our short, sure. But you know, this you know, some people investing hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars into a movie hoping to get a, you know, a pickup at a festival like South by Southwest, and not only hoping for it but needing it, you know, going into huge personal debt to get to that place. That, you know, that it is, you're right, it's much tougher because, you know, with South by out of the equation, what's, you know, what's next? There's Tribeca, and then there's, you know, in terms of festivals, yeah, that naturally. But Cannes was saying, you know, they potentially might close down too.
Well, that's my other question. Is, do you worry about all these other festivals, like the domino effect? I mean, it's hard for anyone to predict the future, but, you know, the Benton Mill Film Festival in Arkansas was supposed to be in May. They postponed. Like, it does seem like a lot of people are looking at South by and saying, like, oh shit, we might be next.
Well, you know, I can almost guarantee that if the city of Austin hadn't stepped in and kind of forced their hand, I don't think South by would have canceled. Mm-hmm. I think they were I haven't talked to anybody specifically about it, but I have heard, you know, rumblings just from reading articles and stuff that they had made a lot of precautions, and that they were going into this, you know, with clear eyes, and knowing that if they put it on, they were going to have to be very careful and you know, and look after the health of the people attending, you know. But, you know, like I without the city of Austin closing them down, I think they probably would have continued on. So I think really it's, you know, almost all these other film festivals, I have to imagine, are in the same boat, that, you know, unless there's external force from the government, you know, just making an overall health decision. You know,
yeah, I mean, some of the European film festivals are entwined with the government in a way that South by really all the American film festivals are not. And so it really becomes a matter of only under edict of the law would something like Cannes shut down. But it's so out of, I mean, it's who knows what the world will be like in 2 months and in a month. I mean, it's hard to say, but I think April is kind of on hold at the moment.
It's a very scary time, you know, for people in general, you know, trying to figure out what this, you know, the impact of the coronavirus is going to be. And, you know, if it's going to be something that flashes up and goes away, or if it's something that, you know, we're going to have to, you know, take real drastic measures against, you know, all that's still unknown. So, you know, nobody can predict.
Does this change the immediate math of when you guys are planning on putting the short online, say, or distributing it through other means? I mean, you said you're going to be at some other film festivals so long as they continue. But does the not having that big South by premiere, does it make it more urgent to share the short however you can?
Well, yes and no. I think that it's actually, if anything, it might delay us putting it online in a weird way, because as I'm sure most of you know, like you if you submit to a film festival, if you want to go the film festival route, the great majority of them will not program you if you're online already. That's just right. how it works. Like if you look at something like Lights Out, you know, was, you know, a huge sensation online, but it only played one film festival, you know, and you'd imagine that that would have been something that would have been a guarantee for so many festivals. But the thing is, you know, they put it online first, and they went viral with it, and, you know, that was their win. But, you know, film festivals don't program you once you, you know, are available online. So, you know, it really, I think no matter what, we were trying to hold out to see what the early fall festivals were going to do with us. That would really dictate when it goes online. Obviously, we want people to see it, and we want people to see, you know, all the hard work. And, you know, I mean, it's so funny. It's a 5-minute short, but like a year's worth of work went into it.
Do you want to talk a little bit about what the short is? You know, it's a horror short. It is especially short, so we don't want to spoil too much about it. But do you want to give the pitch?
Yeah, I mean, the log line is that it's about a pair of arguing sisters who stop at a rundown roadside restroom that happens to be next to a really creepy playground. And one of them just, you know, has to go and makes the call, goes in and finds that there's something in there that's wanting to play a game with her. So it's definitely we tried to emphasize, and I'm not sure if you guys had a chance to see it yet, but
I did.
We tried to emphasize like kind of this feeling of a mythology, and we tried to do it, you know, in 5 minutes, because you've covered film festivals, you've seen shorts. Nothing gets under my skin more or makes me like take a deep breath when I'm agree to watch something and I'm like, I'm going to watch a short film and it's 47 minutes. You know, there's nothing worse than a long short, because then it's not short. It's contradiction. So yeah, that was the challenge. I mean, it's definitely, we wanted to show a little supernatural thing. We wanted to show off a creature. We wanted to show off, you know, have some tension and show off some of the talent of our local, crew, and Ashley Landavazo, who built our set. The bathroom was a complete set, so whenever anybody watches it, that was 100% built on the soundstage.
I'm glad nothing like that exists in real life, honestly. It's terrifying.
Oh, I'm sure there's worse out there. But I've seen worse out there. But yeah, and so we just, it, you know, it's what's incredible about this process, and I'm sure, you know, when you talk to any filmmaker on a, you know, big level or small level, what's really fascinating is the stone soup mentality that happens. You know, once one person puts something in a pot, other people want to come and, you know, fill it up. And suddenly you started with a rock and then you have this amazing, beautiful, you know, soup that's like delicious and has all the best ingredients. And that's what happened here. You know, we got an Academy Award nominated makeup guy to, you know, that was a protege of Rick Baker, you know, build our creature for us. And then we had, you know, because he did such a great job, we were able to get, you know, these digital effects artists to come in and, you know, do some touch-ups on it, you know, and add to the effect, and that worked on, you know, like Marvel stuff. It's like, you know, it's just really incredible how, you know, how much, if somebody gets excited about something, how quickly that can spread and be infectious.
Yeah.
Yes, you're putting and, kind of the optimistic spin on it. I mean, not like, you know, obviously there's a lot of sadness around it too, but like, it does seem like something like this is a really big blow, but for you, and I imagine a lot of the other South by filmmakers, like it's something to get past, but it's not the end of anything.
Yeah, it's certainly for us, like, you know, but I also, you know, count our, you know, us as lucky because, like I mentioned earlier, you know, we don't have, you know, a family friend that invested $200,000 into it and is desperately needing to get their money back. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, we can go ahead and our ultimate goal was to get it, you know, in front of as many audiences as we could, and also use it as a kind of proof of concept to get a feature going. And so, like, you know, that's why getting programmed just period in the South by was a badge, you know, as a badge of honor and a seal of approval you know, has kind of helped us and in a way, again, just by being programmed. So the premiere would have been our fun, you know, party and, you know, our chance to celebrate all the hard work everybody put into it. And, you know, and obviously getting to see it with an Austin audience like Chattanooga, I've heard great things about, and I'm sure that audience is fantastic. But, you know, having been spent, you know, 20 plus years going to South by, I know the Austin audience would have loved it, you know, and that would have been a great crowd.
Yeah,
you know, all that's our bummer. But like the real, you know, at the end of the day, you know, just being programmed was, you know, was as big of a boost as, you know, we could have possibly gotten. So, yeah, I mean, for these other features, you know, we have the ability to afford to wait, you know, till the fall to show it at other, you know, bigger high profile festivals potentially, you know, you know, but these other guys, you know, I don't know who can afford to sit on their finished feature for 6 months, you know?
Yeah. How do you guys think you're going to spend the weekend since you're in town? Like, I've heard that, you know, there might be some people like gathering in unofficial ways around South by. What are you going to do?
Good question. Right now, my plan is just to sit here and not get sick, I guess. I would actually be very happy to, if there's a movie, you know, quotient to that, because I've heard that like for music, a lot of that's still happening, that there's a lot of bands and stuff had already booked their tickets and they're coming in no matter what. Right. But I haven't heard that the equivalent of that for film yet. Yeah. That doesn't mean it's not being worked on, but yeah, no, I mean, I honestly haven't thought about what I'm going to be doing on Saturday when our premiere was supposed to be, you know, I'm sure that no matter what I'm doing that day, I'll be, you know, I'll have to, you know, kind of reflect a little bit on that moment. And, you know, and again, I'm trying as much as I'd love to make this about me, you know, there's, you know, I don't know, like there's only so much, you know, I don't know.
Self-pity
that I can give myself without making me feel like super guilty about, like, you know, the people that I know that, you know.
Yeah. I mean, we'll be picking up the pieces from, we'll be picking up the pieces from what happened and what didn't happen this weekend for a long time to come, I feel. And the shockwaves will be felt for ages. And I just, you know, I feel like if there's any film community in the country that can find a way to salvage anything from the wreckage of this, it's the one in Austin.
Well, and I got to tell you, like, you know, what's, I know it's become an overused reference now, but, you know, I think it was Mr. Rogers was saying, you know, you look at a disaster, you know, don't look at the victims or look at the mess, look at who's helping. And, you know, that's what gives him hope. And that's one thing that's really blown me away in the wake of all this, is that there's so many people like, you know, Jesse and Leonard Maltin and, you know, I mean, even you guys for reaching out and wanting to help, you know, shine a little bit of a light on the short film. And, you know, I've done a couple interviews, you know, today with people that are just really wanting to step up and help out, you know, the people who are losing some of the spotlight. And if I'm feeling that, I have to imagine that there's, you know, that there's that times 100, you know, for some of these features that are going around out there. So, you know, that, and if the online film community, the film Twitter community, the horror community, they've all been like very quick to reach out and, you know, express interest in seeing the short and, you know, offering condolences and
the nicest,
you know,
thing anyone's ever said about film Twitter. It's really
I know.
The reputation improved.
I know, like they can go back to arguing with each other over whether it's good to ironically watch things next week. But right now everybody seems to be banding together. And coming from, you know, a perspective that's usually, you know, there on the purely the helper side, being on that outside of it, and now I'm on the inside actually seeing it, you know, it's definitely something that, you know, that warms the heart and makes me not feel as down about the situation as I could be.
Oh, excellent.
You guys have anything else you want to ask?
yeah. As long as, that's where we needed this conversation to end up.
You're the real heroes.
For every word of a review of a South by movie I write, I'll just be, you know, feeling Mr. Rogers sending me kisses from heaven.
So David, you're reviewing South by movies this week. I imagine you're not the only one.
By the time this airs, who knows what will have happened, but I'm currently on an email chain with all of the trade critics trying to figure out. We all have different priorities and philosophies about what to do, and obviously what any of these sites, from as big as Variety to smaller like IndieWire, it's not going to have effect on what the other sites do. I've been personally in touch with a lot of publicists, the feature films, you know, and obviously not the studio films that are going to have their premieres elsewhere, but from the indie films that are at the festival, the acquisition titles, and the majority of the publicists and the reps and the filmmakers I talked to today are very, very eager to have coverage of their films, regardless of what happened. So it does seem like on a case-by-case basis, we're going to proceed with some reviews. What we're trying to figure out right now are the, you know, typically what we try to do at a festival is when you can help it, is to, when you're reviewing a title that doesn't have distribution, to not pan something that doesn't have distribution. I mean, it's just as easy to not review it in the first place, because if there are obviously exceptions for very glossy premieres at Sundance or Cannes or whatever, when they're star-studded films that will inevitably be seen by other people and you have a role to fill. But when you're reviewing something like Shithouse, which is a movie I actually really liked, by a 22-year-old filmmaker who wrote, directed, and starred in it, made it on a shoestring budget with Jay Duplass's help and whatnot, if that movie hadn't turned out as well as it had, panning it, especially in the event of South by not happening, would have served no purpose as far as I can tell. It is a bit of a position now where that's heightened more than usual because the festival isn't even happening, and pouring on films that don't do anything for you is just a really negative disservice. But there are a few good ones that we've seen that we'd really like the opportunity to help out however we can. So, and Shithouse is one of them. So look for a review on that later this week if all goes according to plan.
David, as someone who doesn't like leaving your house, is this actually ideal that there's no festival you're supposed to be at? You just get to review everything and stay home?
To parrot what a lot of what Eric was saying, I wouldn't call it ideal. I think I am still sort of just so flabbergasted by the economic and emotional fallout of what happened in South By, and hearing about people losing their full-time jobs there. I mean, it's crushing because it seems so arbitrary. I mean, not arbitrary may not be the right word, given this act of God, but, you know, they're losing their jobs because of insurance loopholes, essentially, because they didn't have disaster coverage. And what's the difference between a disaster and an act of God when you're talking about a pandemic? I don't know. It's just, it's so shocking. So I would not say ideal. South By is a festival that I have not had the pleasure of covering in recent years. And so it doesn't really, when you get really right down to it for me, if that's your question, doesn't really move the needle. But if Cannes is canceled, I will riot. So talk to me then. But well, my heart could not go out more to all the people who are more immediately affected by this.
Yeah, I'm really curious about Cannes just from a geographical perspective, because it's, you know, a 40-minute drive from Italy, which is like the hot zone right now. Yeah. Right. So it's like,
you know, what Cannes has in their advantage, other than a very like, ha ha, the coronavirus is for cowards, like where they'll just give the sick people like shittier badges, is they are in May, which is, far enough away from now that the world could have turned on itself and gotten full The Last of Us. And it's far enough away also that, given that Italy just, you know, self-quarantined the entire country, maybe the threat will be different. It's just hard to say. Yeah. But Cannes is trying to assume an aggressive posture at every opportunity. They sent an email out a couple of days ago at the height of the "is Cannes going to be canceled" rumors at the time. So, you know, that made no mention of the coronavirus and was like, on April 16th, applications for press credentials are up 9%. And so like they're going on full steam ahead.
They will stop this virus through the power of disdain only.
Yeah, it would be crazy, but I just hope against hope, because the entire face of the film industry for the next year would change. So I hope not.
So, hey, what happens when Cannes continues on as normal, but because of the complete mismanagement of the coronavirus here, they just don't allow any Americans in?
I would have to leave 2 weeks early to quarantine myself in Canada or something.
You're going to restart coronavirus in France by sneaking in.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, I mean, I think the attitude, and I think, Eric, you'd probably feel the same, not to diminish the very real threat to people with, to older people and people with underlying conditions. But I think, you know, the personal fear for our safety is probably a lot less than the sort of institutional fear and systemic fear, which is real, and I don't want to diminish. But I think that if the situation were like it is now in France and they did proceed with the festival, I would not think twice about going myself. I would just hope that if I contracted the virus early on in the festival, that I wouldn't show symptoms until I got home so I could get my work done and see the movie.
I mean you also have a young baby at home, right?
But babies are so it's on a knife's edge with this, because the whole difference between me being kind of blasé and me, at least about my personal safety, and me freaking out and just going full on mole person, is that by all accounts babies and young children are not really affected by this. And had that not been the case, I would just be in lockdown mode right now, because I can't even bear to think about it. But
it's going to be a really touching documentary at next year's South By about you being trapped in France and not able to come home to your baby, who's totally fine. And you're totally fine, but you're just on a travel restriction.
This 2 week quarantine in France is the worst thing that's ever happened.
I can't think of a less interesting story about the coronavirus, but I do think that there are going to be so many stories that come out about it. I was thinking a lot today about, like, if when America gets to the point at the end of Contagion where we're all just living inside of our houses for a few months, all of these kids are going to form like very intense romantic relationships online, even more so than they do already, even if with like schoolmates who they would otherwise see. And then as soon as the quarantine is disbanded, they're all just going to like run out of their houses like bees from a hive to bone.
We're going to have a new baby boom. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Or to see each other in flesh and in the flesh and be way too awkward to make their online flirtations real. I don't know. But these are the things that hopefully we will not have to get into a place of thinking about.
No.
Anyway, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Best of luck with the short and everything else.
Well, I appreciate it. I hope you get to go to Cannes.
Yeah, that's the real story here.
You'll be in my thoughts and prayers.
That does it for this week's show. We'll be back next week, so we'll map patches. We think, we hope. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I am not Matt Patches, who usually starts our goodbyes here. I am David Orlek. I am the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Orlek. As we said in our segment 3, you may be able to find some South by Southwest coverage. It's looking that way on IndieWire later this week. If you're curious about some of those films, I do know that tomorrow, by the time this post, we will have done a curtain raiser type feature about the movies we wish we had been able to see at South By. We wrote this as a curtain raiser before we had seen any of the movies, so it's not helpful, but in a critical way, but it would be a good reminder or cliff notes of the kind of movies that are playing there that you can keep an eye on, help out the filmmakers going forward. Anyway, you can find us all on iTunes at Fighting in the War Room. Leave us a review, and we will read it on the show. And you can make technical complaints to Dave, technical praises to Dave, anything that you want. Find us on Fighting in the War Room on iTunes.
And I'm the aforementioned Dave. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can also find me on The Storm, a Lost rewatch podcast, which is benefiting because we're wrapping up season 2 and Damon Lindelof is back doing press. So let's see if we can get him back for the season 2 finale and hope that Damon Lindelof has a different project every time we conclude a series of Lost. You can also find more of this podcast at fightinginthewarroom.com, including our legacy feeds, which are episodes that are too far back in history to fit on our main feed because we are Fighting in the War Room and we are eternal.
I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at VanityFair.com and on the Little Goldman podcast, where this week I talked to John Magaro, the star of First Cow, which is delightful, as I said, and you should see it, and it's a fun interview. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich, and we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where you can talk to us about whatever you want or your quarantine viewing. It's our lightning round question, which was,
in honor of a pandemic, what were you watching while self-quarantined?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.
Bum, 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 bum. No, I'm done. We're done.